funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the place where students learn affect their prospects for success? While the design of a school's curriculum tends to get more attention than the design of its physical spaces, my guest today says the research is clear that a thoughtfully structured campus environment can pay big dividends in terms of students' engagement in learning and mastery of content. Victoria Bergsagel is founder and director of Architects of Achievement. She's in town to speak to the North Texas chapter of the Congress of New Urbanism about the neurobiology of learning. That event takes place tonight at 7 at the Addison Conference Center, and there will be another set of talks next week at the same time. You can find more at cnutx.org. Victoria, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
In general, what differentiates a well-designed school from one that doesn't work so well?
Well, there are a variety of things we can look at. One of the clearest issues is daylighting, good quality daylighting. So orienting the building correctly, making sure that good daylight gets in for students, indoor air quality, things like size, the human scale of the building as opposed to large mega schools, places where kids can interact, where they can be curious, pursue their curiosities, where they can do what we call inquiry-based learning.
So talk about what we might remember from the classrooms when we were kids that turns out to be not so great in terms of making a school really work.
Sure. There are a number of things that you might think about. Some of us call it the cells and bells model.
I know exactly. Without you even explaining, I know what you're talking about.
Another way to refer to it is the egg crate model. Mm-hmm. A double-loaded corridor, boxes on either side of the corridor, and especially as you get into higher grades, you go into a cell, you listen to a teacher drone on, much like Charlie Brown, wah, 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 and then the bell rings, you're released from your cell, and you trundle off somewhere else and sit down, and once again, that didactic instruction just comes, just kind of waves over you, as opposed to involving you in more hands-on learning, in more project-based learning, in more in pursuing your own curiosities.
So, how does that change if instead of moving from one cell to the next, you're in a different kind of space?
Well, you get to learn to collaborate better with others. And that the whole fault with that didactic instructional model, especially in, again, older grades, is that we'll remember about 10% of that a year later, as opposed to when you really are doing more projects. We're better at that with little kids. And some of the repetition is important for little kids to learn your timetables and things like that. But if you have a classroom where there's a lot of movement, there's so much to be said for movement in education. Just simple exercise raises cognition. It helps. It oxygenates your blood. Therefore, it puts more oxygen into those areas of your brain that cause you to learn and remember things, the hippocampus.
So sitting in straight lines for 45 minutes or an hour at a time, not a good idea.
Not a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Talk for a minute about what specific sort of achievement deficiencies might be addressed by retrofitting existing schools.
Sure. Well, there are some simple things that we can do back to the point of daylighting. So often, you know, probably up to about the 50s or 60s, we had nice big banks of windows that, you know, the light streamed in. And then given the energy crisis and other things, all of a sudden we started to board up those windows. Sometimes we even have windows, but for some reason they've been painted over, boarded up, or teachers display student work right where the good daylight could come in. So that's a simple fix. You can do a lot of things with furniture. So again, even if you're in a box like classroom and you can't knock down walls and things like that, you can create zones in the classroom. You can have different types of furniture. There's some research that says if kids are moving and fidgeting, because if you think about it, we don't sit still as human beings. If you know, I defy anyone to try to stand somewhere perfectly still. You'll start to move and waver. Kids' attention spans are better if they can move and fidget. So so furnishings like a movable chair, much like our office chairs, are probably better than those really stiff pieces of furniture.
And what about sound management? Sometimes schools can get really noisy.
Right. Well, there's a lot of ways you can mitigate for that. It depends on what type of space it is and how it's used. So if you're in a cafeteria, those are often cacophonous spaces. Mm-hmm. So you want high volume, not just a low ceiling. You want walls that aren't 90-degree walls so that the sound just doesn't bounce around. So irregular walls. You want some things that will absorb sound. So you can do all kinds of acoustic attenuation, everything from the ceiling tiles that absorb sound to bulletin boards to sometimes rugs.
It makes so much sense. You know, I have four kids in four different schools, and a couple of them are not allowed to speak to their neighbors at lunch because the noise is so chaotic. But these changes would make it possible to bring back socialization.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Talk about how the building itself can be designed to actually help students, be a tool for learning.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's everything from sighting, where you sight it. So often schools are now being placed on freeways or near freeways. I can cite a couple of examples in Will tonight of schools that are basically built right on a freeway. The research says that that is just horrible for our kids' lung development.
Let alone walking to school.
Exactly. So where do you sight it? Again, the human scale. Can kids walk to school? It's much more healthy for them to walk to school than not. Do you sight it on a east-west axis so that you maximize the daylighting, prevent thermal exposure? You know, you have a much better chance of taking care of temperatures, et cetera. So there's sighting. Then you start to think about what are really the guiding principles around which we want to operate. So if you have a guiding principle, relationships at the center, you said your kids can't communicate in the lunchroom. Mm-hmm. If you want to create a real collaborative, relational setting, then once again, you just think very carefully about how you do that. Teachers often feel very isolated. So they go into that box, close the door, and maybe don't see very many others. So things like what we call clusters of learning. So you have a number of classrooms surrounding some kind of community space, glazing on the wall so a teacher can look through a window and see kids that they've sent into that community space and be able to visually supervise them while they're teaching their class. Those are the kinds of things. There's some colleagues and I actually wrote a book, and we talk about a number of patterns of good school design. So clusters of learning, transparency, indoor-outdoor connections, those types of things really help.
Indoor-outdoor, so sometimes landscaping can matter as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely, it can. And do we have easy connections? A lot of schools today are putting in glass garage doors, nano walls, where it almost there's a blurring of the line between indoors and outdoors. A seminal school back in the 40s, the Crow Island School in Winnetka, Illinois, it's still hailed as a great school, and it had little learning patios for each one of the classrooms. The classrooms were in L-shape, they were child-sized, and then there was just the exit to the outdoors, and kids can grow things, develop things in the garden. A lot of middle and high schools, and even elementary schools, have outdoor classrooms. They have learning walks. Sometimes they're associated with wetlands or other neat opportunities for kids to get out and actually learn in nature.
So let's talk about school size, because I know you have some firm convictions about the fact that a lot of American schools have just grown too large. And mm-hmm. it's not even a matter necessarily of student-to-teacher ratios. It's the entire school itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The research is pretty clear that the school size is more of a predictor of success than actually class size. Mm-hmm. For class size, you have to get down to about a 14-to-1 ratio, which is really unrealistic in most places.
Financially, anyway.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. But if you really look at some of the Tony independent schools, they do operate at that level. So the research is just very clear. Craig Howley talked about how research can mediate for poverty's effects. Just by virtue of being a kid in a small school, the trajectory of your life is much more positive and you'll achieve much greater. And it's a study that he's replicated across a number of states at this point. Small Schools Great Strides is another study that the dean of the College of Education at the University of Washington, Pat Wasley, and some colleagues talked about. Now, they also, and a key influence from her study says, small is necessary, but insufficient. So just because you make it small, if the instructional modalities stay the same, if you're only looking at structure, then that could be problematic. But if you just think about some really folksy advice that Debbie Meyer gave, and she's a grandmotherly type who is very intellectual as well. She's a leader in the small schools movement. And she said, we really need to get to a place where a group of teachers can sit around a table, share a group of students in common, and be empowered to do whatever they need to meet those schools' needs.
Let's talk about why schools got so big in the first place. Of course, there are financial considerations, but there was some research that was largely misinterpreted, or some influential thinking that schools needed to be a certain size so that they could offer the kinds of classes that would challenge students. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. Conant, James Conant out at Harvard, who was a chemistry teacher by training, decided that, you know, after Sputnik, we were afraid that the world was passing us by and that we weren't competitive anymore. So we began to look at all these. There were just hundreds and thousands of small one-room schoolhouses or very small school districts, schoolhouses, et cetera. And so to raise the opportunity to teach higher end math and chemistry, he said we need to consolidate. Now, that consolidation movement, when you really look back at the history, he was really talking about schools of about 500 or so, especially at the secondary level. He wasn't talking about the mega schools. I've worked extensively in Los Angeles, for instance. And when I first started working there in 2003, they had schools well over 5,000 students.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And when you talk about the benefits of being in a smaller school, I would imagine there's some leadership opportunities. You know, it's easier to become, you know, a member of the football team or student body president or something if you're in a school of 500 kids as opposed to 5,000.
Absolutely. There's more opportunity for you to be involved extracurricularly. And when you are involved, you're much more, you know, if you think about, we have a real sense of and a need for belonging. And I think so often these big mega schools, they're just dens of anonymity. And some kids just aren't well known. They have nowhere to plug in. And that's not to say that you can't find ways to create personalization in some of these mega schools. But usually what happens is there's a certain group of kids who get all the goods, mm-hmm. and a number of kids who fall by the wayside. So again, you go back to research, and small schools not only mediate for poverty's effect, they increase parent satisfaction, student satisfaction, attendance. Violence goes down, discipline issues go down. So if it's personalized, if you're known well, you're much less likely to act out. If you're known well, you're much more likely to plug in and be involved.
So most districts are not in a position to raise the mega schools that they mm-hmm. have built already. One idea that you have, though, is taking an existing school and sort of carving it up into pockets with some shared spaces. Can you mm-hmm. talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. And we learn a lot as we walk schools and walk campuses with the teachers who live there and also the students. And if you look, if you took a Google Earth map and looked down at a campus, well, I fly all the time. I can look down and see schools all over the place across the country. And sometimes you just take that Google map and you look, and the building will often tell you how it can divide itself into smaller schools. So you think about a number of issues when you do that. You say, okay, how do we get the resources closest to the kids? So first thing is contiguous space. What grouping are you going to put together? Who are you going to put around those kids? So at the secondary level, it would be a variety of subject matters. So no longer are you departmentalized necessarily, but you put an interdisciplinary group of teachers together in a space. You figure out, how do we put all of the resources kids need into that space? So counseling, administration, et cetera, and create its own little neighborhood, as it were.
Victoria Bergsagel is my guest. She is founder and director of Architects of Achievement. She's in town to speak to the North Texas chapter of the Congress of New Urbanism tonight at 7 in Addison at the Addison Conference Center. She'll be speaking about the neurobiology of learning. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can distinguish yourself professionally and personally. Evening classes are available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Victoria Bergsagel is my guest. She's founder and director of Architects of Achievement. She's in town to address the North Texas chapter of the Congress for New Urbanism tonight at 7. That takes place at the Addison Conference Center. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. If we're going to keep campuses small, one solution that we've seen a lot in this part of the country is schools that are just a grade or two on a campus, and then there's another grade. What is there a difference in effectiveness between those schools that stay to 500 or below that way and those that have many more grades in a smaller campus?
Absolutely. It boils down to transitions. Mm-hmm. How many transitions are you going to force a child through over the course of their career? Again, you look at many of the Tony Independent schools, and they are K-12. They've got or they're K-8. There are systems across the country that are moving from these elementary models, or sometimes you have the ninth grade academy or et cetera. There's a variety of things that we can consider. One is if you have more grade levels in a school, then by design you're going to have fewer kids per grade. You're going to be able to use kids really shine when they can teach one another. Mm-hmm. And they can acculturate one another to the great school culture you're trying to build. So the older kids can mentor and care for the younger students. There are systems that are saying that makes a lot of sense. And so Philadelphia was transitioning everything to a K-8 system as opposed to elementary, middle, and high schools.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We will go first on the line to John in Grapevine. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you.
I have two quick questions. Hopefully I can get them to you rather quickly. First one, I watched a documentary a couple of years ago about a gentleman that was testing using very thick fiber optic cable to bring light in through the outside, and it was electronically adjusted to rooms that don't have natural lighting to come through them. And it showed us absolutely beautiful. This natural light just shot through. I didn't know if you've heard of any or seen this before. Also, second question, what are schools doing that have split classrooms, meaning just boys and just girls, to make those classrooms specific for those in terms of constructions and layout, not just necessarily teaching techniques, the actual layout of the rooms themselves?
Let's find out.
My answers off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, in terms of light, there are a variety of ways to bring light in through a ceiling. There's solar tubes that use reflections. There are light shelves, clear story. So there certainly are ways, a myriad of ways. And part of the Congress for New Urbanism speaker series, one of the speakers, not necessarily myself, will speak to those specific issues. So the short answer is yes, I've seen that. It works very well, and you can sometimes even control daylighting, et cetera, through the use of solar tubes, fiber optic cables, et cetera. In terms of split classrooms, that's an interesting one. And I suppose I'll give a bit of an anecdote. I was in Abu Dhabi last year, and I was working with a school system that it had been a school that was built for the Abu Dhabi government, and they decided to give it up. It's right next to Abu Dhabi University, and they decided to give it up to a private international school. And it was a mirror image of itself. It had two pools, two gyms, two everything, because they needed to keep boys and girls separate. Now, in some societies, that's important to them. Obviously, for the British International School, it wasn't. So we need to think about how we could retrofit the building so that it could serve an integrated population. That being said, there are some who very much advocate for single gender classrooms, with the idea, especially at the middle level, that students are much more inclined, young women are just much more inclined to excel and to not be worried about the opposite sex, to ask more questions, et cetera. And same thing, we have a bit of an epidemic with young men in our country that they're just falling by the wayside. Again, they're sometimes more active. They're They are squirrely, et cetera. And so there is, you could certainly look at a building and figure out how to have a girl's wing and a boy's wing, et cetera, if that was really important to you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll go next on the phones to Carl in Denton. Hey, Carl.
Hi there. I'm wondering if your author is familiar with the Open Space School or the Open Concept School that was I was part of in the suburban Houston in the late 1970s and early 1980s as an elementary school student. And I found out later that all of those schools were actually had walls later created, and I guess the experiment somehow fizzled out somewhat. And I'm wondering whatever happened to that concept and what did they find out about using that concept?
Okay. To some degree, there's a little bit of a movement back toward that, but we know a lot more now. When we built those open concept schools, sometimes we didn't pay good attention to acoustics, and so it was rather cacophonous. And I think one of the main reasons is that teachers didn't teach any differently. They taught the way they were taught, and so they stood and delivered, and then you can see how one teacher standing next to another, you know, there was just a raising volume. And if you, again, teach in that didactic methodology, you're just going to be competing with one another. If you teach on a more Montessori type approach or something like that, where kids are pursuing curiosities, doing projects, et cetera, there's often a kind of a low buzz noise, but it doesn't seem to bother anyone because, again, you're focusing. We're paying closer attention to that, and sometimes now what we're doing is we're putting in glazing. So we're actually separating space, but we're giving a visual view across a landscape. So again, if you need privacy, you can keep the door shut. I'm involved with a couple of projects right now that have huge sliding glass doors. Some people put in barn doors, et cetera, where you can, when it's time to be open to the community, you open the classroom up, and when it's time to hunker down and have a little more direct instruction, show a movie, something like that, then you can acoustically protect the space.
For reasons that we don't have time to go into today, there are a much larger number of kids these days being diagnosed with ADHD. Mm-hmm. Are there considerations in the design of schools for eliminating distractions that may make it harder for those particular students to focus on the work that they need to pay attention to?
Mm-hmm. One of the patterns we talk about in our book is varied spaces, because we all need different types of spaces. And we borrowed the whole pattern language from Christopher Alexander, who in the 70s out of Berkeley, he developed with his colleagues about 250-something patterns. And one of his patterns is cave-like spaces. Mm-hmm. You know, kids like to crawl into a quiet little space. Now, there are ways you can build in nooks and crannies into classrooms, both with furniture or architecturally, window seats, et cetera. Looking at libraries, you know, kids are like cats. They want to sit on the windowsill and, you know, breathe in the daylight, I guess, and read their book. So there are ways that we can create those types of spaces. I've seen an urban retrofit in New York City where they took an old elevator shaft that was no longer going to be used, and they put in restaurant booths there where kids could just kind of slide in there and sit on a comfortable booth and work on homework. So with ADD, as you said, we probably don't want to go down the trail of saying why and why is it proliferating. But back to exercise, we know that if kids exercise, that their attention improves. So, and some of the drugs like Ritalin provide the same effect in the brain that exercise does. Exercise mediates for depression, it mediates for attention deficit disorder, et cetera. So again, get kids out and moving. There are just tremendous studies that the more fit you are, the higher academic performance you will have. So, and we know that for adults, we know that for kids, we know that for everyone. So again, those indoor-outdoor connections, the importance of exercise for kids. I have a colleague who's written a book called Brain Rules, John Medina. He's a molecular biologist, and we used to work together at Tolaris Brain Research Institute. And his number one brain rule is exercise. And he actually has a treadmill in his office. So he does his email just cruising along on a treadmill.
It's a great way to sort of keep yourself going on all cylinders, I guess,
during
the workday. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to David in North Richland Hills. Hi, David.
Hi. So my question is regarding this idea of integration across multiple grades, trying to go back to K through 8 kind of system, or K through 12 kind of system. And one of the most serious issues facing education today is a rise in the amount of bullying that's going on. And so how does that, how do those two movements sort of coexist, given that bringing in older kids and younger kids, you still get this increased amount of bullying that can go on? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call. Again, it probably gets down to the whole size issue, and it's really up to the adults to establish a strong culture. And there is a proliferation of bullying. I think part of that is our society does us no favors in terms of continuing to talk about bullying behavior in ways that somehow aggrandized it. So what we want to do, I think, is get those integrated classrooms, the smaller grade levels, but then also be sure that you build a culture, and the adults in the building usually establish the culture. Establish a culture that says we care about one another, we don't bully, etc. And if it's a small enough system, then it's much more likely you're going to control the culture. And I don't mean by heavy-handed control, but I just mean in terms of establishing expectations, doing community building, talking with kids about what it feels like to be bullied, et cetera, and educating them. And once we educate them and really involve them and their emotions in more empathic behaviors, then we see that the existence of bullying goes way, way down.
So, Victoria, as I'm sure that you are aware, we remain in North Texas, one of the fastest growing parts of the country, and there are a lot of areas that are in a position right now to be building new schools and putting new areas in. Many times, in the interest of preventing the cubicle classroom sort of portable additions down the road, they build these enormous buildings. What kinds of choices would you recommend, or what kinds of issues would you recommend they consider before they put in large campuses, even larger than the current needs require?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see how they're trying to save money and build, for instance, core facilities to serve a larger group of students. But I would say, again, build it on a human scale. So if you know that you're only going to build one gym, go ahead and build a gym or one cafeteria. Say you're a high school, and I would imagine an average size might be around 2,000 here. So if you're building a high school for 2,000, you might build the core facilities, i.e. a gym, a wellness center, a performing arts center, or a cafeteria, food service, et cetera, to that larger number. But then think about how to build smaller units across the campus, give them differentiation, and then as you can master plan it such that I'm working on a project in Alpine, California right now where we are doing just that, but we're only going to build two high schools of 400, and they're going to be separate, and then there's room on the site plan for others. The other thing is centers of community. I think too often in society, we bifurcate services and we say, this is the community center for the community and this is the community center for the school, et cetera. We can really save a lot of money societally and actually involve the community more in our school if we build schools as centers of community and think of ways to integrate. There's a really interesting project going on in Emeryville, California right now where they're co-locating a K-12 school with a senior center with community services. And it's a fun little project. It's right next to Pixar Studios. So there's the engagement with industry as well and giving kids an opportunity to use some technologies. So those kinds of things, if you're going to build big, put it there and allow there to be a culture perhaps for each one of those smaller units on the larger multiplex.
What does it take to break through people's concerns that schools have to be almost these sort of fortified places because of security? People are afraid to have anyone come in from outside in the community who's not been double-checked because they're worried that something could happen.
Right. Again, it depends on location. And sometimes you do need to have that security checkpoint in terms of visitors coming onto campus. But when we think about positive negatives. And by that, I mean, if I said don't picture an elephant right now, just don't.
It's impossible.
It's impossible. We do. And so often we treat our children that way. The opening assembly is don't bring a gun to school. Don't do this. Don't. As opposed to you're a great group of kids, you know, and it goes along a continuum of, are you going to foster respect and responsibility, or are you going to foster command and control? And so there's so many little subtleties about the way that, you know, architecture speaks to us. It tells us how to behave. So there are so many things that we can build in that say, I'm building a fortress. And there's so many things we can build in that one of the patterns in the book, again, is greeting and gatekeeping. So you want a gracious greeting, perhaps not the counter that comes up to your chest and says, stay, you know, I'm behind this counter, stay back, to a lower threshold and more kid-friendly. But there's definitely an adult presence there right at the point of entry. So there can be a gracious greeting, but then by design, there's also a little bit of gatekeeping. Who are you? What's your business? Have you checked in, et cetera?
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Mark, who is driving down I-35 carefully, I hope, Mark.
Yes.
Good.
Thanks. Victoria, listening to your comments, I am thinking about your comments in relation to Montessori, mm-hmm. philosophy of education, as well as kind of how Montessori, at least my experience with Montessori, architecturally, how classrooms are set up, integration with the landscape, things like that. So I'm curious from a parent's perspective, your research, does it indicate that Montessori has some sort of positive outcome when it comes to architectural integration, and as well, I'll ask just philosophically, just to pick one thing, Montessori will take older kids as well as younger kids, put them in the same classroom. So, for example, the school that our kids have gone to, 3 years together. So first, second, third, for example, will be in the classroom. The older kids will be kind of helping with instructing the younger kids in, you know, quote-unquote lessons that they have mastered.
Let me stop you there, Mark. We need to take a quick break. We can get Victoria's response in just a couple of minutes after we take this break. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. My guest this hour is Victoria Bergsagel, founder and director of Architects of Achievement. She'll be speaking tonight to the North Texas chapter of the Congress for New Urbanism. That takes place at 7 at the Addison Conference Center. If you'd like to get to us via email, that address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can distinguish yourself professionally and personally. Evening classes are available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is founder and director of Architects of Achievement, Victoria Bergsagel. She's in town to address the North Texas chapter of the Congress for New Urbanism tonight at the Addison Conference Center. The event begins at 7, and there is another one next week with different speakers that you can catch as well. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, Mark was asking about the design of Montessori schools.
Mm-hmm. So, and I think Mark's question was multi-pronged. He talked about multi-age. He talked about the type of instructional methodology. And so I think in terms of multi-age, again, we can build a culture where we all learn together. Society is multi-age. So, you know, we learn from the young, we learn from the old, we learn from one another. We're all little scientists trying to figure out our world. So there's, in terms of the research, and Mark mentioned Montessori, but I might also mention the Reggio Emilia approach that Howard Gardner, who of multiple intelligence fame, Harvard professor, thinks the world of Reggio Emilia. And it's a society, it was a town in Italy that after the war had been devastated. And they said, if we're going to invest in our future, where should we invest? And they invest in their children. So they have a very strong early learning approach. And every school has an atelier. Kids are constantly on the move. They're working together. They're working collaboratively, et cetera. So there's just a ton of research that says that collaboration, that active learning is very powerful and important.
An email here from Chris says, locally, the Plano high schools are very large, but they seem to show up on all the best school lists. What do you think those schools are missing because of their size?
Again, I'd like to disaggregate the data. I'd like to see who's achieving at high levels and who isn't. More often than not, when we really start to unpack that data, we see that kids of color aren't doing as well, and then kids of a lower socioeconomic status aren't doing as well. And sometimes that information is hidden by the high test scores of others. So I'd first want to disaggregate the data. There are those who say you can't really find a researcher who says, please, please build a large, comprehensive high school. There's one, Valerie Lee out of University of Michigan, who says maybe 600 to 900 in order to offer the type of classes that a university understands and wants in terms of preparation for. And again, sometimes it depends a little bit on what's the preparation.
Right.
So are you preparing for a large anonymous institution? Are you preparing for a smaller liberal arts institution? And can students – and what is going to be measured in society? Probably not our SAT scores down the line and probably not our ACT scores as much as can we articulate articulate ideas well? Can we work with others? When you look at Murnane and Levy wrote a book out of Harvard called The New Basic Skills. And, you know, we certainly need basic skills, but they say the basic skills are you need to learn to work in a multicultural society, you need to be able to communicate well, things that aren't necessarily measured by test scores.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Ashley in Richardson. Hello, Ashley.
Hi, good afternoon. I had a question for your guest. I'm a bilingual educator, and I know that in Texas, bilingual education is very important to us. I was wondering if you had any ideas on school makeup to help benefit bilingual education and lower socioeconomic students, and if you had any ideas on any better ways to make that work.
Thanks for your call.
I'd say across the board, we need to work on language development earlier. Scientists talk about windows of opportunity in brain development, and we're developing language when we're very young. So kids will just naturally pick up languages very well. There needs to be the human connection. There's a gal named Patricia Kuhl, who is out of the University of Washington Center for Mind, Brain, and Learning. She's probably the world's leading language acquisition expert. And so she talks about how we really do need to involve ourselves with kids early on in language development. But also, one of her most interesting studies recently was she had her Chinese graduate students play with children in Mandarin. And then there was a control group, of course, that listened to tapes. The human connection was phenomenal. The kids did learn the language when there was human interaction. They didn't when it was just simply tapes. So I'd say the ways in which we can involve kids in exposure to various languages much earlier. Some would say if you compare Henry Kissinger, who has an accent, he came to this country post-puberty. His brother did not and therefore doesn't have an accent. So you can look across a developmental timeline and look for those windows of opportunity for how kids best learn, and then you begin to implement those skills. But the human connection is key. And again, it gets back to personalized education and kids learning from adults as opposed to being sit in front of a TV to listen to a language tape or interact in some other way.
What needs to happen for educators and architects and designers to understand each other's languages and each other's needs so that architects can communicate what's possible and educators can communicate what they're trying to do?
Mm-hmm. We need to be really careful about how we approach that. And that's in part why I founded Architects of Achievement. I found I would often go to school planning meetings and see that architects were speaking architectese and educators were speaking educationese. And they would politely nod their heads and listen to one another.
And they're all smart people.
And they're all very smart people. But there just wasn't that dynamic communication. And there wasn't sometimes I think one of the keys that we can key approaches we can take in terms of our processes are first look at the research about kids and how they best learn, identify guiding principles, what's most important to you in terms of what approaches you're going to pursue, and then use those guiding principles to really drive the design. And every time you get into some kind of an issue where given a world of limited resources, you can't pay for everything, and a priority needs to be set, you go back to your guiding principles. Those then become the common language. And those begin to – and the other thing I would say is that I often take educators, architects, community leaders on what I call study tours. We're inquiry-based learners. The best way to learn, we can certainly do it virtually. There's lots of information on the web. You can give a PowerPoint. You can have discussions. But the degree to which you can pick up as a group together, link arms, and go somewhere and explore something, you'll see things you like and you'll see things you don't like. But it helps you get clearer on your priorities and your guiding principles so that when you come back and begin to design your space, the more interdisciplinary, the better. So not just educators and architects, but planners, developers, community leaders, those who love and nurture kids everywhere, those who are in the know, involve them as much as you can. And don't forget student voice, because that's really clearly powerful. And I've seen kids just really shift a whole conversation just because they're kids and they're speaking from their hearts.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line is Lon in Plano. Hi, Lon.
Hi, Chris. I actually had the chance to meet you once. I had a quick comment and question. One thing that I know is I grew up at going to a very small school here in Dallas called Prairie Hill Private School. And you really get a sense of the teachers there. They really do care about you. And they really work with you strongly. But I noticed a big shift when I went off to university. I went to Colorado State, where everything seemed centered around the Student Life Center. I mean, you'd walk past and you'd have sort of free area where people could talk and write down their ideas. You know, people would bring chalk and give their own opinions and their sort of things. I thought it was just a very interesting way of expressing, you know, yourself out in the open. I think it's important to do that. I was just wondering what your speaker thought today.
What do you think, Victoria?
I think that is a great way to develop citizenship and to create, again, those areas for collaboration, to throw your idea out up on the wall and everybody gets to take a whack at it, as my grandma used to say, and to share ideas and to share projects, et cetera. We're seeing that more and more in the university setting, and we're trying to build it into more and more public schools. So say, for instance, the Digital Commons in the School of Architecture at the University of Washington has just that space. They took an old basement, actually, and renovated it. The students built furniture, and there are little nooks and crannies where if you need to study quietly, you can plug in there. And if you want to sit on some couches and collaborate, there's a whiteboard there, et cetera. There's a number of projectors set up that you can plug in your computer and share your ideas electronically. So colleges have understood that for quite some time. And then it becomes an issue of scale. So how do we do that in a public school? And do we have, say, for instance, the Marysville Getchell High School project that I'm working on in Washington State has a large community commons connected to a wellness center, et cetera. And it's almost akin to, since it's a high school campus of four small schools, a biomed academy, a school for the entrepreneur, an international communications academy, and an academy of construction and engineering. So very different foci, four small schools of 400. Within each of those small schools, there is just what you're saying. There's three-story buildings, and there's actually that type of space on all four floors. And then, but so you could actually spend your entire day right there, with the exception of maybe going out for PE and going out into this beautiful out into some of the beautiful outdoor classrooms, or you could pick up, and if you want kind of the bigger scene, kind of like going to the Student Union building or something, you can pick up and walk a little bit across campus, across the little bridge, and go, you know, kind of plug in, because kids like to see and be seen, and they like to get beyond just maybe sometimes that 400 student grouping socially. So they get a little bit of both. They get to make a choice. But where the priorities are let's pump all the resources into the kid, into the academy. And then if you need to go out, you do that. So you're seeing that more and more. Even on large campuses, there are things called freshman interest groups, et cetera, where they identify kids and say so that they plug in. Because there's a tremendous attrition rate in the freshman year of college.
I was interested to read about the trend toward making high schools in particular more closely resemble the workplace as opposed to traditional classrooms. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I sure can, and I'll just stick on the Marysville-Getchell example. Mm-hmm. The architect once said to a group touring the campus, which will open this fall, I defy you to find a hall in this space. And they've recaptured the circulation space and made it just like other. You know, we sometimes on study tours take people to Google's offices or to an ad agency or even an architectural firm where you have groupings of people around doing individual work. Minnesota is really big on this. There are a number of schools from the Zoo School just outside of Minneapolis to Hip Hop High in St. Paul, where students have an individual workstation and they're co-located with a variety of other students in their advisory, and they have an advisor co-located there as well, and they're working on projects, and it's much more student as worker as opposed to teacher as worker or as opposed to teacher as the sage on the stage.
Yeah.
They're more like the guide on the side.
It's so interesting, too, because right now the only time they get that sort of workstation experience is when they go home and they're doing just hours and hours of homework.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sort of incorporate some of that.
Right. And even for teacher development, I think it's really key and important. And you can often put teachers in teacher offices as opposed to leaving them in their classroom. Mm-hmm. Because I know, having spent many years as a public school teacher, that most of your professional development happens actually in a vicarious fashion.
Mm-hmm.
You're struggling with something. You observe another teacher do something great, if you're lucky enough to be able to have eyes into that classroom. Or you're talking over lunch and you get a great idea. Or you can kind of say, oh, I'm puzzling with how to deal with this. And how to deal with kids, not just your subject matter.
So clearly some of this takes significant investment of resources. And I was interested in the fact that your approach looks at not only cost per student in the school, but cost per graduate. If you can keep more kids graduating, then the additional investment in building these great facilities would seem to be worth it.
Oh, it's absolutely. It's very clear that small schools graduate more kids. It's the shame of our nation that we don't graduate more kids. Because to think about the tragedy of what will be the trajectory of their lives. In Detroit, and again, we're looking at four-year cohort graduation rates. So if you measure from starting ninth grade to 12th grade, in Detroit, the number is 27%. In New York and Los Angeles, it hovers right around 45%.
And that's not that dropout. That's kids who graduate.
Who graduate. Those are the graduation rates. So the majority of kids are dropping out. So what happens to them in their lives? The NYU back in 1998 did an interesting study that looked at small schools versus large schools. And when they looked at small schools and looked at graduation rates, they came up with students graduating at a rate of about 95 to 96%. If they looked at the traditional city-based school, the number was, as you know, as I just mentioned, 45-50%. So it, you know, just because you park your car, well, if you build a car, if it doesn't run, you're not going to stay in business.
Makes
but
sense.
Somehow we put kids through the school system, they don't succeed.
Victoria Bergsagel is founder and director of Architects of Achievement. She's in town to speak to the North Texas chapter of the Congress for New Urbanism about the neurobiology of learning. You can learn about that event and about next week's event at cnutx.org. Victoria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.